Dear Mr. Potter, we are pleased to inform you that you have been accepted at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry.
You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
A wizard, and a thumping good one, I'd wager, once you trade up a little.
No, I can't be a wizard. I mean, I'm just Harry.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's bonus Wizarding World of Harry Potter retrospective series.
Mr. Potter, our new celebrity.
The boy who lived, come to die.
Hosted by Brock.
Well, I'm sure we'd all be fascinated to hear what you have to say.
Stuart.
You won't last 2 seconds if he invades your mind.
And Arnie.
Why is it when something happens, it is always you three?
Believe me, Professor. I've been asking myself the same question for 6 years.
But be warned, this episode will contain detailed plot spoilers and strong language.
Now, there's absolutely nothing for you to worry about.
Tell me, has anyone ever believed you?
You told them not to worry?
Well, my philosophy is that worrying means you suffer twice.
Listener discretion is advised.
You wait till my father hears about this.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Do enjoy yourself, won't you? While you can.
Today we're talking about Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, starring Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, Emma Watson, Jim Broadbent, Helena Bonham Carter, Robbie Coltrane, Warwick Davis, Michael Gambon, Alan Rickman, Maggie Smith, Timothy Spall, David Thewlis, Julie Walters, directed by David Yates. Merlin's Beard! This is Brock, co-host of Now Playing.
And Stuart.
And this is Arnie, the Half-Blood Podcaster.
Oh, I thought you were a full-blown podcaster. I had no idea you had one podcasting parent and one non-podcasting parent. Welcome to our 6th episode in our Harry Potter retrospective series. We talked about briefly when we recorded Books and Nachos as the penultimate book, but this is not the penultimate movie. Or is it? Because the next one is in 2 parts, so is this really the penultimate movie or what?
No, it isn't. It's the penultimate movie before the penultimate cash grab.
I'll tell you what it is. It's the movie that made me walk away from Harry Potter. This is the last Harry Potter movie I've seen before. I was in theaters for the 3D showing that I paid $25 to sit my ass in front of. And I kid you not, it's only one scene. There's some 3D like glasses that flash on the screen. You put it on for one scene. All I could remember about this movie is some damn dumb dude walking around like a couch. And that was the 3DC.
Oh my God, that was it?
That was it. I was mad. It wasn't just about that. It also helped that my Harry Potter friend and I stopped being friends. I didn't get dragged to the movies anymore. But I was mad to pay $25 to see Jim Broadbent do 5 minutes in a 3D couch suit.
That's weird. I knew the last movie had a segment in 3D, but it was about 10 or 15 minutes, and I'd read this had 3D at the beginning and the end. If that opening with all the spirits wasn't 3D, then fire whoever did the conversion.
I agree.
It might have been. All I could remember about this movie, I had two images burned in my brain. Jim Broadbent as furniture and Dumbledore falling out the window. That's the only two things I could have told you about the damn movie.
And both were 3D?
No.
And I would think the bridge scene and the burrow would be the two scenes that I would want to see in 3D here. This is the first Harry Potter movie I did not see in the theaters. Me, the Harry Potter fan here, did not get there. So I have not seen any of the remaining Harry Potter movies theatrically for the first time. At this time, we had a baby girl at the house. And so we did not go to the movies. So we just waited for this to come on DVD before we saw it. And as a result, the streak was broken for me.
And I've never seen this film before. Now I've seen it 2.5 times. I'll just say I fell asleep the first time I watched this movie for this review, so I started over.
the last time I rewatched this was my daughter had finished book six. She was reading the books first and watching the movies. And so the last time I watched it was a couple of years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years now at this point. And so watching it with her now, she has since read the book a few times, or listened to the book more than read it again with her audiobooks. I had just finished the book for Now Playing, and I tried to rewatch it on Magical Movie Mode, which is part of my Blu-ray I have, and I too fell asleep watching Magical Movie Mode. But the first time through with my daughter, I did not fall asleep.
Why did they get David Yates again? I thought we all agreed Order of the Phoenix was on the weak side.
David Yates coming back was a curious choice for me because of everything we said last time. However, it seemed like they stacked the deck for him so they can get a different result. They got Steve Clovis back, and they got a brand new cinematographer who, by the way, got nominated for an Academy Award for this movie.
Also, they hired Yates before Order of the Phoenix was released.
Hmm.
It was still in production, and they're like, you want to just keep going? And he's like, yeah, I'll take a job.
Okay. I mean, sometimes that's easier. I mean, if you can, like, just stay on and help us get through this whole thing. If you dedicate your life to Harry Potter, and it really does feel like David Yates stopped making anything else, I think, other than bad Tarzan movies.
Well, there are other people who wanted the job, though. Quaron, I thought, said he wanted to come back. I thought they asked Mike Newell again, but maybe they stopped asking him after he said no the first time. And, of course, they went back to Terry Gilliam, I thought, and he said no.
Did they go back to M. Night?
No.
Not that I can see, no.
But here's what's interesting. Remember I said they were talking about when they were envisioning the series, they could recast the children? This is the movie where their contracts were up, and Emma Watson almost didn't return.
I'm not sure she did return. She's barely in the movie.
Yeah, it was a big whoop-to-do. Is she coming back? Is she coming back? And eventually, I don't know what changed.
They upped her salary. Come on, this is hard-nosed negotiation 101.
But she was in school and she wasn't loving acting, and she's great in the movie, the parts that she's in. But yes, this movie is not Hermione's movie. But the official word is that she didn't want anyone else playing the part. She felt a sense of ownership over it. But, I mean, I can't imagine she'd play that hard a ball at her age, and she had no other part. She didn't want to act. She wasn't doing anything else or much of anything else. She was definitely focusing on schooling at this point. So that official story seems more likely than not most of it.
I just like her quote was, the pluses outweighed the minuses. So they had to add more pluses to that paycheck.
There you go.
I don't blame her.
They did recast a role, though, because they see younger Tom Riddle in certain flashback scenes here. They couldn't use the guy from the second movie who was young Tom Riddle because he looked way over 30 at this point. He totally aged himself out, so they had to recast that. And I read it is Ralph Fiennes' nephew. They got to do one of the younger Voldemorts.
A Fiennes casting choice.
Ah, that sounds like nepotism. That's more like, okay, we'll do you this favor. We got millions of kids that want to do this. In fact, every kid on the planet will say yes to this, but we'll let Ralph Fiennes get his family more involved.
Wow, you guys are so cynical. I mean, isn't it nice? It looks like him, and it's a good idea. No, nepotism. No, salary, blah, blah, blah.
That kid ain't Damien. I'll just put it this way. We'll get into it when we get into it. Despite any grousing I might be having, this thing was as big a hit as any of them. I think The Midnight Show opened like one of the biggest of all time, 22 million. And that was back when midnight shows were literally, you had to be 11:59 and then click. Nowadays, they run those things at 6 o'clock on a Thursday and call it midnight show. Preview night. But yes, this thing opened huge and played huge and was the third biggest hit of the year next to Avatar and, God, Transformers 2.
The series is unstoppable. They don't make Fantastic Beasts for nothing.
This is the first movie, though, to come out with the final book published. So people seeing this movie already knew the secrets, or those who are reading the books. The people who are still sticking with the movies still don't know, but I'm sure someone sitting next to them could have told them.
That's interesting. And again, I haven't even read the next book or seen the next movie, so I can't even imagine how that will influence, but it would color your viewing, I would imagine.
Yeah, to me, at this point, I knew these movies kept coming out. I knew that when they came out, they were number one at the box office. I gotta say, after that last book came out and I read it, it's not like I hated it. We'll talk about it when we get to Books and Nachos in a couple weeks. But man, it just felt done. I'd read the last book. I had no more use for Harry Potter in my life.
Wow. To me, that doesn't make any sense for how I'm wired. But I get where you're coming from. You're not the Harry Potter fan, and your wife and you don't sit there and talk about it. And you have other friends who are reading these books and watching these movies, too. And now with kids, it's a whole new thing in our lives, right? With my daughter loving these books, and it's been so much a part of our lives these past few years because she's really into it. And she's taken this series as a jumping off point and reads all sorts of series now because these books got her into loving reading. And we are thankful to Harry Potter in our lives. And so what you just said to me was like, wow, that's amazing.
But even you didn't go to theaters for this.
I had a 4-month-old, 5-month-old daughter.
I thank you for that. I thank you for not bringing 4-month-old children into a movie theater. If everyone would follow that lead.
Exactly.
I'm just saying, if it had been Star Wars, you'd have found a way. Life finds a way, as Jeff Goldblum says.
I would have gone on Friday night to see Star Wars. My wife would have gone Saturday because we would have traded off. Right. But yes, if it was Star Wars, I'm not missing Star Wars. But this is not Star Wars. This is Harry Potter, which I do like. I'm a fan of it. But yeah, Star Wars is my thing.
Well, then what is it? Arnie, give him the plot and we will get into the Half-Blood Prince.
Harry Potter and his friends Ron Weasley and Hermione Granger have returned to Hogwarts for their 6th year. Despite a war going on between Voldemort's Death Eaters and the rest of the wizarding community. It's because of this war that Dumbledore spends extra time with Harry, revealing specific memories about Voldemort's life. Also this year, Snape finally got the promotion he's wanted for years. He's the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. This brings back to Hogwarts the old potions master, Horace Slughorn, played by Jim Broadbent. Slughorn is a sycophantic narcissist who loves to name-drop the famous and powerful people who were once his students. He's most keen to establish a close relationship with Harry, the Chosen One. This desire is something Dumbledore counted on when bringing Slughorn back to Hogwarts. Slughorn was also a teacher of Voldemort decades earlier, and Voldemort, then known as Tom Riddle, confided a secret to the potions master. Dumbledore tasks Harry with finding out what was discussed. When Harry brings it up, though, Slughorn becomes closed-lipped and distances himself from Harry. But Slughorn can't deny Harry is a gifted student in the potions class. While Harry had never been adept at potion making, this year he has help. His borrowed textbook is full of helpful notes and hints ascribed only to the Half-Blood Prince. Harry has no qualms about using this edge to become top student in the class, much to hard-working Hermione's frustration. Hermione is frustrated for other reasons, though. She's come to realize she has a crush on longtime friend Ron, but Ron has started dating fellow Gryffindor Lavender Brown. Hermione commiserates with Harry, who's also pining for one he can't have, Ron's sister Ginny. But over the Christmas holiday, Harry and Ginny almost kiss and eventually begin dating. But between all the dating, snogging, and Quidditch games, something dangerous is afoot. First, one student is nearly killed when she touches an enchanted necklace. Then Ron nearly dies drinking poisoned mead. Who is behind these attacks? Harry, of course, suspects Draco Malfoy, who does seem up to something suspicious. He's been given a task by Voldemort, and Snape has vowed to help Draco and protect the boy on this mission. Finally, thanks to a good luck potion, Harry gets the information needed from Slughorn. Voldemort had asked the potions master about splitting his soul. If you commit murder, your soul is torn apart. Wizards can then put that torn portion of their soul into any ordinary object. Once the soul is in the object, that object is called a Horcrux. As 7 is a special number in magic, Voldemort tells Slughorn he's curious about tearing his soul into 7 pieces. When Harry gives that memory to Dumbledore, the school's headmaster doesn't seem surprised. In fact, 2 of Voldemort's Horcruxes have already been destroyed. The first was Tom Riddle's diary, which Harry destroyed in the 2nd movie. Dumbledore also has gotten a ring and destroyed it. Now Dumbledore wants to journey for the 3rd Horcrux, a locket, and he takes Harry along for backup. The 2 take a treacherous journey and get the Horcrux locket, and when they return to the school, they find Malfoy waiting. His mission was to kill Dumbledore, and he tried through the cursed objects that hurt the other students. He's decided just to use his wand for the murder, but now that he's facing the old headmaster, Draco can't bring himself to pull the trigger. Snape steps in and kills Dumbledore. Harry faces off against Snape and some of the Death Eaters Malfoy snuck into the school, but Harry is powerless to stop Snape, who reveals himself to be the Half-Blood Prince. With Dumbledore gone, Harry tells Hermione and Ron that he, Harry, won't be returning to Hogwarts. He's going to continue Dumbledore's mission of finding and destroying the Horcruxes, of which four remain. The locket Harry and Dumbledore retrieved was a fake, stolen from Voldemort by someone who signed a note with the initials R.A.B. Ron and Hermione say they're going with Harry on this journey, as credits roll.
Would have been so much better if it was O.D.B. Anyway, this movie's got a lot thrown at you right at the beginning. I want to talk about the scene that makes the least amount of, like, it goes by really fast in the middle of all the stuff catching up with all the characters we love. First of all, Helena Bonham Carter has not emerged as much of a force in the series, but she has this one scene where she streaks down from the sky as a black smoky comet hanging out with a werewolf, and they appear to break into a shop and put a bag over someone's head, and I don't know, did they take them to Gitmo? Like, what was that?
I believe she kidnapped Ollivander, the wand maker.
Oh. Was John Hurt still alive?
John Hurt was not in that scene. They put a bag over his head, so I'm assuming they got a stand-in. But he died years later. He was in Doctor Who, if you remember. He was the war doctor years after this movie came out.
Okay. And then they blow up some millennial pedestrian bridge as well, to give you the sense that even muggles know something is wrong. They look up at the sky and they see death faces.
Now look, this is the scene that was alluded to in the book. They showed it to us here. It was different bridge because this bridge wasn't built in the times the book takes place. All of that stuff, I thought the bridge looked terrible CGI. So while I understood exactly why they're opening the movie this way, to show the real danger that wizards are posing on the real world, the muggle world, I thought they could have at least spent a little more money on that terrible-looking bridge that falls apart. And strangely, no muggles die. This is a PG movie, so perhaps the reason nobody died on that bridge, because they wanted to make it terrifying, but not a PG-13 terrifying.
You know, I'm just going to say right out, I think this movie looks bad, and I don't know if it was just the Blu-ray I was watching, but again, I tried this on two different televisions, the blacks are muddy, the effects aren't great, it feels like there's a film over the lens, but I'm pretty sure they're just desaturating all the color and make it colorless and gray, but part of it feels like it's lit like a diner at 3 a.m. when you're on a bender. I think this is an ugly-looking film.
They actually had to, in post-production, ease up on the looks they were going for because of issues that you're talking about. But my Blu-ray transfer was terrible as well. We saw a lot of dancing artifacts going on. Not so much in the blacks as much as in the whites against the blacks. When there's a dark background and someone's face was in the front,
yes,
or a shirt was in the front,
yes,
it was like something was going on. And I turned to my daughter and I said, this has to be the Blu-ray transfer. It can't be anything else.
I watch a lot of dark movies on my TVs, and I've never seen anything like these Harry Potter movies have done. First, part four with the caretaker, and now throughout this movie.
And I would say that if you somehow accepted these production values, I don't think they're that different from what we've gotten before, but they're not great. I'll give you that. They're not tremendous visuals. It's just not true. This movie is telling you, oh my god, the world is about to be split apart by a big wizard war, and there's almost no action scenes in the rest of the movie. Most of this movie will be about sticking your face in a bowl and looking back at the past.
In fact, Stuart, two of the biggest action scenes in this movie are not in the book.
Right.
It's this scene here and later on at the Burrow.
They had to find them because they recognized how uncinematic the book was.
They start, though, with a fun scene, I have to say, after the bridge attack. I like the thought of Harry flirting with some waitress, and he was going to go pick her up at 11 o'clock. That's more regular teenage boy than I've ever seen Harry be.
Agreed. It's almost wrong, right? Because he is 16 and she looks like 20 or something, but it could be a fantasy. And again, it's well played. The actors are fun to watch. She's struck by the fact that I think she pretends not to know that he's the chosen one. He's reading one of his magic newspapers, but she does. She must know that, well, the whole world is now trying to celebrate Harry Potter because he was vindicated by the last movie.
I don't think she knows.
She's a muggle. She's not a wizarding person. She's in a muggle diner.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Yeah.
Then why would she go for a 16-year-old boy? I think that's a crime even in London.
Maybe because it's Daniel Radcliffe. I don't know what to tell you. She certainly looked older than he.
Okay. I read that scene wrong. I thought for sure she was pretending to be a muggle and then was like, haha, I know who you really are.
Let me split the difference here. She could be a wizard living in the real world, taking a real job. I don't know why she would, but like Hermione every summer went back to her dentist parents. So it's possible. We're never going to get actual clarification on this point because Harry has to stand her up. I mean, you could read into this. Oh, this old man came and took me away and now I can't be with a girl.
That's the plot of Back to the Future, I think. I really loved Dumbledore enjoying it. Also, he brings it up later on after their scene with Slughorn about how he basically prevents Harry from getting a date. I think Dumbledore secretly enjoyed making sure Harry didn't get any, almost like a fun thing he would go back and tell his brother or something. I love this scene too. I love how the movie opens. I love how the train moves and Dumbledore is there. I love the visuals of these scenes greatly in the muggle world with the wizarding, because we spend so much time at Hogwarts and surrounding areas of wizarding here. I really do enjoy the scenes where, instead of being at the Dursleys, being in the real world.
I like the big sign Dumbledore was standing near. It was like a billboard perfume ad, and it's, tonight, make a little magic with your man.
And so he does, arm in arm, almost like Mary Poppins. He whisks him away, or apparates, I guess is the technical term that they're saying here. Of course, it's a 652-page book. They took shortcuts, but the movie could just be these two reconstructing the story of Tom Riddle. They don't do that. I'm kind of surprised that instead it's just about going to see this boob, Horace Slughorn.
What they're doing here is they decided that they're going to be very select about what backstories we do see, and we're going to focus on what we can film easier and better with Slughorn. And I liked how Jim Broadbent plays his character. He makes the character come more alive than the book does. Here's a good example of a good actor accentuating what is on the page. I think he does a really great job of playing up the superficiality. A magical person who has so much power and knows so much is fallible to that he wants to be associated with famous people. It's a very something a lot of people that we know or have met or have read about have this quality, and it's a wonderful difference between someone like Lockhart, who just wants to be famous and thinks he's the greatest thing. This guy thinks he's great because he knows famous people. It's a really kind of a great idea and a wonderful juxtaposition to Harry Potter, who doesn't want to be famous at all, and he feels that it's a burden. It's very interesting to me that they chose to focus on the relationships in this movie of all the characters to each other much more than what the majority of the book is, or at least the best parts of the book are, in my opinion, going into the pensive and finding out about Voldemort.
I guess that's what I was saying. I would think you'd really want to make this the prequel in which we see a whole lot, more maybe than even was written, of young Voldemort. Again, I assume when we go to this creepy house, we're going to see where it all began and the history of the mom and the dad and all. That's so laid out in the book. But no, they want to just... I guess this movie wants to stay in comedy. For as grim and as desaturated as you're talking about, Arnie, the look of this movie is, it largely has the spirit of a playful romantic comedy. I mean, again, a scene with a man dressed as an armchair walking around.
In the early scenes for the first half of the movie, yes, there's a lot of humor here. And any time just about that we're going to deal with Slughorn.
Right. Soon after this scene, we have the joke shop scene also, which has a lot of playfulness to it too. Because in between those scenes, we have Bellatrix and her sister Narcissa going to visit Snape.
And yeah, this is an interesting moment, particularly in the book, because it asks, one of the big mysteries of this is, the whole series is, should we trust Snape or not? I've been in camp, oh, all the bad guys end up being father figures. Here we see, I guess it's Draco Malfoy's mom, and whoever the hell Helena Bonham Carter is to anybody, coming in here and making Snape promise to help Draco be successful in his mission for Voldemort.
Right. Now, Bellatrix is Narcissa's sister. Bellatrix is also a cousin of Sirius Black. And as I mentioned last time, the woman who's playing Narcissa, who is Malfoy's mother, was cast to play Bellatrix, but she got pregnant. So they had to cast Helena Bonham Carter as a last-minute replacement for her. So here they get to have a scene together. Maybe I'm putting too much into it, but I really enjoyed watching the looks they were giving each other. The subtleness of the acting compared to when you have Timothy Spall popping his head through the door when he's bigger than life. the three of these people are really having a serious scene in, you know, a magical movie. I really enjoyed this scene very much.
This movie, more than any other, is going to take away from Harry Potter's point of view. The other movies, again, they've had perhaps one opening scene that wasn't Harry's POV. But here, we're getting this scene. We got the opening scene with the bridge, which would normally be the scene we'd get. And then later on, we're going to be following Draco on his own. So, in order to tell the story Rowling wrote in the book, I guess Yates decided there was no way or no desire to just make it everything as Harry sees it.
Yeah, to condense the story, you have to follow Draco around. His vanishing cabinet appears much, much earlier than it does in the book because they decided to do that much like they did with Barty Crouch Jr. in the fourth movie instead of revealing him at the end like they did in the book. It's a really good choice to give Malfoy some character work. This kid doesn't speak most of the movie, but he's acting up a storm in every scene that he's in. You can really see he's internalizing things. He has opening scene with Harry on the train where he speaks. He speaks later on, of course, in the finale, but in a lot of those middle scenes, he's just sitting there staring off into space or crying at a sink or not saying anything at all, but he's conveying so much his tortured soul.
Yeah, he's finally good. Like, I mean, let's just face it. This character has been awful in all the films.
Now, wait a minute. You mean he's good as an actor, not the character's a bad guy, Stuart?
I mean, this little, like, blonde Dracula has been really annoying and not an asset to this franchise up until this one. And now he has a good hook. His father went to jail. His mom is making Snape promise to make him successful. And Voldemort, of all people, seems to be putting all of his plans now on Draco, what, we think killing Harry, but maybe, you know, wiping out all of Hogwarts. We don't know. It's a good tease that this kid looks like he's ready to do something really malicious. He's talking early on about not even attending in his seventh year. So we know it's going to go down in this movie.
They did something early on, too, that they did in the third movie. We complimented how they had the poster of Sirius Black screaming at us at the screen. It was very effective. Here, when Draco was in Nocturnality, they tried to do the same thing with a character named Fenrir Greyback, who it's not entirely clear here in the movie that he's a werewolf, who is so down the path of being a werewolf that he's actually a werewolf during the daytime, not just when there's a full moon, like normal days. And that's why he's so hairy. But I found the poster here being less effectual than how great it was in that third movie. But I understand why they're condensing all of that stuff, because you really don't need it.
They make it kind of clear with his makeup job. I mean, I didn't think he wasn't a wolf.
Something is a little too short here. Yes, we have this moment where we always go to Diagon Alley, but the only shot that's doing well is the Weasley Twins novelty shop. Everything else, as you pointed out, the wand maker was hauled away with a bag on his head. We don't really understand what has been going on. If you read the book, it's a little more clear that there's these World War II metaphors going on, that the way that they came for the Jews is the way that they've come for all of the good wizards. I think you needed that, honestly. I think you really needed to understand that this was going to be a different year for Harry because all the things he's normally hanging out doing, it's kind of been ruined here.
Again, it's a PG movie, right? So they're not going as dark there. But this movie very much has Harry being very much in a normal year at Hogwarts, quote unquote, because much like the second and first book, they're pretty much staying at Hogwarts almost the whole time. The only time he ventures out of Hogwarts is the end or when he's in the Pensieve. If they did all that stuff they did from the book, it would be a whole different movie. Here, they don't want to go that dark that soon because they know the ending is coming.
That's a mistake. You told me that every book was supposed to be more mature. We shouldn't be going back to a PG movie. And you feel it when we get a scene that is so brutal in the book. That train ride to Hogwarts where Harry basically thinks he has the upper hand and gets the crap kicked out of him, you can't even feel that in this scene. The idea that his nose got broken, my mind imagined it when I read it on the page.
They did a brutal sound effect, but I can't say it's as bad as I pictured in my head when I was reading it. But they still have Draco stomp the guy while he's on the ground, and that crunch, I mean, it's not American History X, but it's not gentle.
It wasn't what I wanted. And again, I like the fact that Draco is a threat. I do think that with that scene, it really felt like, oh God, he is going to do something horrible. They seem to be pulling back on that a little bit. And yes, they're promoting the goofy, like, are they trying to say that Luna Lovegood and Harry could be an item? It didn't occur to me until these moments when they're walking to school.
Well, she comes back later on, too. Harry brings her to a party.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I think everyone thinks of Luna as a fun person to have around, but she is also around in this quite a lot. It seems like she's even in Gryffindor. She's even at the Quidditch tryouts. I mean, she's also wearing a lion's head because she's rooting for Gryffindor during the Quidditch match, but the amount of time she's around, she's supposed to be in a whole different house, and it just seems that she's always around. Now, she makes a big deal last movie of how she doesn't have any friends, and now she has friends, so maybe that's all it is, but it just seems to me that they just wanted to make sure they had as much Luna as they could at all times here in this movie to the short shrift of, say, Neville.
Right, yeah. Some characters, Cho Chang, I thought she was going to be big. Neville, they were saying last time with what he happened, he's practically another Harry. Not in this movie or barely in this movie.
Yeah, I felt bad for Neville in this movie. He gets like two lines.
Indeed. And then they have like other things. They have that one kid who blew himself up over again in the first couple of movies. He blows himself up again here for like a running gag. All these kids come back for another Harry Potter movie, but they're just basically extras.
Sex and drugs, though. This is like, I mean, they're 16 years old. And I tell you, almost every scene involves the kids drugging each other and trying to make out with each other. To me, I would want to be exploring the darkness and the origins. That's what we've come for, particularly now that you build up to these worldwide stakes. But I feel like this movie, its best moments are with the kids being kids and partying. And it's not as good as the fourth movie. I can say that. I am missing Mike Newell. I do feel like I wanted more of the romantic chemistry if that's what they're going to focus on. But it is kind of the best thing going here in the first half of the movie.
I do love, before they go to Potions McGonagall, that scene with her in the hallway about going to Potions class. I thought Maggie Smith was a delight. When they go to the class with Potions and Ron and Harry look at each other and they both try to grab the nice looking book, that is exactly what teenage boys would do. They have so many moments like that in this movie. Those are two examples that popped out immediately that they really remind us all of these are kids and they enjoy each other's company and they're in high school and he's allowed to be a kid again instead of being ostracized like last movie. You mentioned trying to drug each other. That whole aspect of Harry faking out Ron and Hermione catching on and then Harry calling her out. It's just the relationships between them, how when Harry calls out Hermione for putting a spell on the other guy, the playfulness, the back and forth, we get a sense these people really know each other very well. It was a welcome return instead of being so serious all the time like it was last movie for these kids. These kids are allowed to be kids again, and I greatly enjoyed the way the actors were portraying that. Yes, it's a whole different tone. Yes, the movie looks visually different in a lot of reasons we've talked about before about why that is. But I think what's going on here is because interspersed with that, you have that scene where the girl gets cursed by the necklace, where Ron almost dies, and all these scenes with the penance. They're really trying to make a balance. They don't go too far dark because if they go always dark all the time, this movie could be seriously depressing, sad, and hard to take. They really want to make these other scenes balance that out.
I agree. I think these kids have been working together for so long that they probably have chemistry off screen that they're bringing on screen. I do think everybody here knows what they're here to do. Draco, Harry, Luna, they've done it several times. And yeah, I have no qualms about them. What I have qualms with is, what are they doing? I had to write a plot summary of this. What would you guys call the elevator pitch for part six?
You can go over to Books and Nachos. I think the problems begin there. And I do call them problems. It is like Rowling was saying in that book, oh, there's a whole lot of data dump I need to do before we can actually get a climax. So, yes, what happens this year doesn't feel particularly interesting. I guess the pitch is Harry's textbook. It has been previously written in the margins by some mysterious person who identifies as the Half-Blood Prince. Who will that be? Is it Voldemort? I think that's the thrust, Arnie. My guess is Harry and Voldemort battle over a textbook. Yeah, that sounds bad. You're right. It's bad.
So I hear you because the movie is called Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, but even less than the book, the Half-Blood Prince really doesn't matter in this movie, in my opinion. They really don't do enough with that whole Half-Blood Prince. You can't not call it Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, but a better title would have been Harry Potter and the New Potions Master, or Harry Potter and the Pensieve, or something else.
Can I throw out there, would it have been blasphemous to make Voldemort the Half-Blood Prince? Would that have just pissed off fans too much? Because when Snape goes, I am the Half-Blood Prince. It is so out of left field. It makes so little sense. If you're gotta keep the title, do you have to keep it Snape?
Yes, you do. But also, if it's Voldemort again in a book, we've done that already. We've had that plot already. You don't need to do that plot again.
And we don't have Voldemort in this movie. We don't have Ralph Fiennes. What we have is Tom Riddle. When we do have Harry looking back in the past, Dumbledore occasionally shuffles him into his office to show him memories. What we see is scenes from the X-Men.
Yes, I thought that. He is so Professor X.
Yeah, let me recruit this orphan whose powers have alienated him so that he can be taught how to control it and be part of a community of like-minded magical people. Yep, I definitely think they were thinking about that. Again, my instinct would be, and I know it wouldn't be popular, let's not do as much with Radcliffe and the other kids. Let's really have a prequel. I would really have liked to have spent time with Tom Riddle. Little moments aren't satisfying.
Correct me if I'm wrong, we only have two pensive scenes, right?
Yes.
Whereas in the book, there's so many of them. It's like every third chapter, and we really get into Voldemort's backstory with his mother and his father and the love potions, which helped balance the romance stories that we're going to see in here, because there was also a parallel of how Voldemort's parents romanced. And so I'm just a bit thrown that they would really only do one scene of him being recruited, and then later on one scene of him talking to Slughorn.
Yeah, and I don't think this kid's very compelling either. Again, I would get a star. I would get something for Tom Riddle as cool as Ralph Fiennes. And they've minimized him. What this movie's doing well is the light stuff. What I wanted was the focus on the dark stuff. So whenever it's trying to do the dark stuff, it's where I'm feeling frustrated. But I do like the Draco scenes. He does have this mystery about disappearing into a room. Harry still has the Marauder's map. He can see him going places, but he'll run up there and like it's a wall. And we know that Draco is like doing something with a vanishing cabinet. This cool thing where he like sets the apple in and then it comes back and there's a bite out of it. And boy, does it look, you can just imagine like that's Voldemort's fangs going into that thing. All of that buildup helps. Like, it at least reminds you that this isn't just a teen romantic comedy. Otherwise, you'd forget that.
So the vanishing cabinet reminded me of The Fly.
Sure.
And they really laid that out really well throughout the movie here, because you can't apparate in and out of Hogwarts. That's why you can't have them disappear. Although what's got me about the Room of Requirement, which is where he is that, for what I understand the Room of Requirement to be, is that the room is what you need it to be. So they were able to practice the DA last time in a big empty room with all the weapons you need and things like that, so you can practice. But Draco's in a big room full of junk because people use the Room of Requirement to hide stuff in, right? But then when Harry gets in there, why is he seeing all the same stuff? I don't understand how the Room of Requirement works in this movie versus how it worked in the last movie. And if that's in the books, I don't get it either. But for here, it just seemed like a movie convenience why Harry was able to see the vanishing cabinet in the Room of Requirement.
It's worth repeating, the movie last time was written by a different screenwriter. The movie this time is Stephen Clovis again. And I just want to say, I think he's making some pretty good choices. As we've already complimented, things that are not in the book, funny stuff, is here thanks to him. If only he had written the last one, I think it would have been better. I'm going to just go ahead and say, I think this movie is, in some ways, and only in some ways, in the ways that I'm talking about, as a reduced experience, this is more satisfying than the book. It's taking certain things about the book and making a pretty fun time for the first half.
And as for the Room of Requirement, it is said in the book, when you're needing a place to hide something, they all get the same room. I mean, Professor Trelawney, I really wish they'd gotten Emma Thompson back to do the scene, revealing the teacher to be this terrible drunk who needs a place to hide her wine. And when Harry goes to hide the book, he's hiding it among all these other hidden things. So if Rowling can roll with it, I guess I can. But could either of you help me understand this cabinet? Because you said The Fly, Brock, and in the book, that's definitely how it came off, is it's a passageway, you know, a wormhole. You enter one, you come out the other. But here, we see Malfoy put an apple in and it comes back without a bite. Okay, well, maybe it went to somebody, somebody bit it and sent it back.
Yeah, Voldemort.
Right. Well, not Voldemort, but someone else.
No, because it would be in that shop.
Yeah, that's where I think he is.
So earlier in the movie, we see the bunch of Death Eaters in the shop with Draco. In the book, he's by himself in the shop. There's a whole scene in the shop. But we're only talking about the movie here. So early in the movie, when they go into Nocturne Alley, we see Bellatrix and Fenrir Greyback and Draco in the shop setting up the cabinet there. Draco puts the bird and puts the apple in there. And he's testing out, he's trying to fix this thing so it will work as a transporter from there to here. And that's what it is. That part I get.
Yeah, what's the confusion?
Well, I'm confused because he puts in a feather and it disappears. He puts in a bird, it comes back dead. To me, this is a transformation cabinet, not a teleportation cabinet.
No, he's communicating with the guy that's giving him the orders that he's got to obey. And it's more menacing that we're not seeing Ralph Fiennes opening up the cabinet and then biting the apple and breaking the bird's neck.
Okay, I didn't get that, but sure, I'll go with it. I thought those scenes were confusing.
Those are some of my favorites. Again, those are the things that make this still scary. The stuff that isn't scary, that's supposed to be scary, are when, like, the kids are possessed to try and bring cursed necklaces and all of this stuff. This was not great. This Katie Bell subplot, they should have done something else.
I found that effect very convincing. I liked that a normal day turned into a horrific one because of witnessing that. I love that the button, why does it always include you three or whatever, something like that, McGonagall says.
That was a good line.
And then Ron says, believe me, I've been asking myself that for 6 years. Very funny. So they were able to turn it around and point out to the audience, yes, we're aware. These three are always where the trouble is. That's fun, too. The scene when Ron gets poisoned and the love thing, again, that turned an innocent moment into a scarier one, but not as scary as it could have been.
Rupert Grint was great as the foolishly in love guy. I thought he really played that comedy well.
He played a guy who is so upset that he couldn't play Quidditch to a guy who thought he had luck in his system and he played really well. Then he had the scenes with the girl who was in love with him and he had the scenes where he wanted to get rid of her. He had so much to do in this movie and he was great in every scene he was in. He did a really great job with everything they threw at him.
You're right. The scene of him being the great goalie and the scene of him being celebrated after when Lavender finally kisses him, he is. He's really good.
So again, I'm really enjoying all the character stuff, all this time with these kids, at the expense of some of the more interesting things I found in the book, but I'm really enjoying the movie.
Yeah, this is what I'm saying. But the Katie Bell scene sucked. That wasn't scary, and that plan is stupid.
I actually kind of like the Katie Bell scene, where she rose into the air and shrieked.
Yeah.
I thought they were aping some horror films there.
It's not scary. And again, the whole plan was she's going to somehow carry a possessed necklace to Dumbledore. Why would he take a necklace from a student?
Well, I love how later in the movie, Dumbledore just calls out to Draco that these are the best you can come up with. The kid didn't want to do it. That's really what it is. The kid's clearly indicating that the entire movie, this kid is put upon to do something he knows he has to do that he doesn't want to do.
I wish that were a little different.
I agree.
Again, I don't like the fact that Draco's plans are so bad. Because he is menacing in this movie. Because you do know that he's working on bringing something into the school. And I just feel like the best I can say it is this. If you're doing so well with the light stuff, but you're on the sixth movie, which is supposed to be more scary and world-threatening, you gotta bring more scary here. It is out of balance. You need to adjust that so that it feels equally ominous as the cute. What's weird about this movie is it's shot like a dirge. You know, you look at it and you're like, God, this thing's so washed out and ghastly. But it's a romantic comedy. It's like the ugliest romantic comedy you've ever seen. It just seems like they have a lot of good elements here. They have a good writing here. In little moments, it's funny or even kind of spooky. It's just not congealing. And that was a problem in the book as well. The fact that you have Slughorn here, Jim Broadbent, very good actor. I do like his take. I do like seeing his slug fest dinners where he's trying to court which student is going to be on my shelf. Who deserves to be among my favorites? And Harry's mother is one of them. All of that, that's good tension here. But all of it, what really gets learned about this whole Horcrux thing? It's a long way to go from you've got a memory that's clouded and you've changed and we've got to pull another memory out of you. And so I'm going to get you drunk with Hagrid because the spider is dead. I mean, like, really? This is how we're going to find out what Voldemort's plan is? How he broke himself in seven pieces?
So much in this movie is not set up, like the dead spider. At least in the book, Hagrid had told people, hey, I'm having a funeral for a spider, come on down. Here, they go down, there's just a dead spider there.
I like that much more. I thought that cutting to the chase in that aspect and how they truncated all of it, I thought they got the gist of what they needed to, and then Harry used the special luck potion to make all that happen. I thought that was great.
Not only that, but they've changed it into comedy. In the book, we're really supposed to feel for Hagrid losing a friend, and they spend a lot of time on that remorse. And here, it is a physical comedy bit that a grown man is standing in front of this shriveled spider and weeping. This movie is playing it silly.
Well, they also cut out everything to do with Hagrid except for this one scene, right? So something had to go, and the Aragog stuff is easy, and then not taking his classes, all that. It made sense to me of how they truncated this particular. I have no problem with how Harry gets Slughorn drunk and all that kind of stuff. I think that was fine.
Let me be sharper to the point. Rowling was bad at plotting out the story. This was not the way to find out how the bad guy set up his plot. These weak-ass pulling memories out of heads and sticking heads in bowls and all of that is just kind of lame. It's not proactive. The characters aren't doing anything but watching, and that's just not fun.
I also have a problem with Rowling bringing into it, and I mentioned this on Books and Nachos, but in case you're not listening there, I really have a problem with her bringing in this luck potion, because I don't see why everybody isn't using luck potion all the time. I understand it's hard to make, but guess what? If the Weasleys can make big bucks with gag things in a store, somebody could just make it rich by creating a factory assembly line of luck potion.
I guess what I'm saying is the book was kind of messy, and the screenwriter's doing what they can. Some things don't make sense, or some things have been tweaked to mean less than they did in the book, but they do recognize that this movie needs to have energy, and that's why I think comedy is the way to go. And they create action too. There's a whole thing on the Weasley farm with all of a sudden Helena Bonham Carter gets to do something with fire.
Yeah, but I'm watching that scene and I'm like, I don't think that was in the book. And then when it's over, I go, what did that accomplish? What was their mission? They just wanted to burn down the Weasley's house? They're vandals?
Yes, this is here because they need an action scene. This is all it is. This chase through the weeds or whatever that is, and they burn down the house to prove a point because the Death Eaters are causing havoc.
That seems more like mischief than havoc. I mean, you're not a Death Eater. You're a arsonist at best. I mean, why the Weasleys? The Weasleys have so little anyway. I feel bad for them that their house gets burned down.
Here's the thing. If you did not have these moments, like Brock said earlier about the wanted poster and the way that it opened and here and Tech in the Field, you wouldn't even know who this werewolf was at the end of the thing. Here, they're at least, again, this is told by filmmakers that are trying to dramatize and make exciting all the data dumps and stuff that is in that book. So it's needed in the sense that you know who the bad guys are. They keep popping up throughout the movie, and that's helpful. Just in the same way that we're reminding of, like, things they're giving to do with Ginny. Like, I feel like Ginny is doing more in this movie than she did in the book.
Definitely.
And they're making the love moments between Harry more clear, frankly, than they were in the book. I just think that the writer understands how to take what was important about that book and shape it a little bit better so that it's at least playing in this 2.5-hour film.
I completely agree. I think why we are losing aspects of, for example, the Half-Blood Prince really doesn't matter in this movie, in my opinion. The aspects of the plot of the book that do matter to tell the story to get us where we need to be at the end of the movie are heightened. And I agree, all the choices they're making to make this movie entertaining and tell the story at the same time, I'm agreeing with. I have no problem with them burning down the Burrow, reminding us who the villains are there, that villains are around. Of course, given that Draco is supposed to do it all by himself, do we really need to bring those guys into Hogwarts to begin with? That's also debatable, but the point is of showing that there's evil and the evil is trying to get into Hogwarts, that nowhere is safe for Harry. The Burrow is a place that's supposed to be safe for Harry. That is no longer a place Harry can go, and these Death Eaters are trying to get into Hogwarts, which is the last place then Harry has that he is safe.
Yeah, again, if anything, I wish they were changing more about the book. I mean, throw out the Katie Bell scene. That, again, I'm just trying to imagine how that was going to go down. Hey, Dumbledore, wear this great necklace. And then he dies. No.
You will not get off this necklace. Okay, we got it.
Or Slughorn. Like, I've got a bottle of wine and I'll somehow get him to drink it or something. Like, it just, they're piss poor plans. they're not good in the book, but there's so much going on in the book you don't notice. Here, because things are pared down, you just say, if it's not good, we'll change it. And so often they do. They make scenes funnier. I'll put it that way. The funny stuff is funnier here. This is a funnier movie than it is a book. And I wish they had the same instincts for the suspense, because it's starting to look lopsided and a little bit overlong.
I agree. There's not enough plot here to justify this runtime. There's not enough logic behind it, and that's from Rowling's book, as to why Dumbledore needs Harry to get Slughorn to give the information. There's a war going on. I get Slughorn would be reticent, but to send in the 16-year-old boy seems a little bit odd, and this movie just really struggles to maintain my interest. There's a reason I fell asleep the first time I tried watching it. There's just not enough going on here to keep me engaged. Although I will call out, I said everybody gets one good scene. Harry, when he is on the luck potion, I really enjoy that performance. And Hermione, when she's crying about Ron. It's not a comedic performance the way the two guys have, but I really felt for her in that scene.
Yeah, I agree on everything you said, except I very much like the stuff with Slughorn and why Harry has to be the one to get the memory. It allows for the Slughorn character, for the Harry character, for the Dumbledore character, all to have more depth. I think playing off Slughorn's weaknesses, Dumbledore knowing that he can't do everything by himself, Harry having to do something on his own sets him up for where he has to go in his journey. It is a mission that Harry has to accomplish, something seemingly impossible, figures out a way to do it. It very much helps Harry's character as a person, helps him grow.
So what is Slughorn's big pain here? He changed a memory so that no one would ever know the shame of the fact that Tom Riddle got him to... he didn't exactly teach him how to do the spell. He just told him it involved death, right?
Right, and I think he says, I think you know how to make a Horcrux, Tom. What are you asking me? And he says, can you do it more than once? Can you split it up into more multiples? And they talked about, he feels guilty that he gave...
That he said, I think you can?
Something like that.
That's just not very good, right? There are opportunities here. Sorry for the fundamentalist, but you could fix what Rowling did not with the book. They did make it cuter and funnier, but they're not making it more exciting and suspenseful and more engaging.
I think the whole thing with Slughorn works better in the book than here. I don't think that anything was wrong in the book to fix. I think the reason it's clunky here is because of all the stuff that they've cut out regarding Tom Riddle's backstory and things like that.
Okay, it's clunky all over is where I'm at. But we're pretty much at the climax, I think. This is where Dumbledore is... Why are they going to this cave?
Okay, so the cave has a Horcrux he's found. He knows it's there.
How did they do that?
He's Dumbledore.
He's Dumbledore. Okay. Yeah. And isn't there a scene about the cave is special and all that kind of stuff?
You tell me. Probably. It's obviously special. It's got filled with like dead people swirling around in water and you drink a whole lot of crying juice.
Yeah. So in the book, the cave has meaning to Voldemort. So they track down this location of where the locket is. And before they do that, they apparate there out of Hogwarts. And we talked about this last movie that I don't think you can apparate in out of Hogwarts. And Draco Malfoy's plan the whole time with his vanishing cabinet is because you cannot apparate in and out of Hogwarts. But Dumbledore calls it out as if last movie they realize they made a mistake, and he says, certain privileges I have by creating all these spells, so we could just basically make it easier than us walking down the Hogsmeade and having an extra scene.
Yeah.
It was purely for plot convenience they apparated to this cave.
We like the idea of having the climax come back to the clock tower. There's just something satisfying about that. So they leave the clock tower after Snape is complaining about something. I don't quite get it.
Well, that will come into play later.
Okay.
But not today.
Yeah, they have to, I don't remember what happens in the last book. I really don't. And I haven't seen the last two movies. But this has to be some kind of setup. I view it as Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan, when Spock's about to die and he puts his hand on McCoy's face and goes, remember. And that kind of left a door open and you're like, what is that?
Right.
Yeah, Snape accuses Dumbledore of asking too much of him. I can only presume it's I'm killing you, but I don't quite get it. They'll have some mumbo jumbo for it. Hopefully it won't anger me.
This one I think you'll be okay with, but Arnie's completely right. They're going to this cave because they're setting up the Infinity Stones of the series to, there's a bunch of things they have to collect and destroy instead of collect and use.
Wouldn't you have done this earlier? She talked about doing it in book two, I think.
Right. They did talk about it.
Wouldn't you have wanted that? Wouldn't that have helped?
So the story is, and it's not completely clear here, I mean, I thought it was much clearer in the book again, but they do explain enough of it here that Dumbledore has taken great pains to break it down to these key memories that made it clear what Voldemort is actually up to. And he didn't know for certain until he got confirmation that he did indeed hide his soul in different things so he can be immortal. So the book was his first clue that he created Horcruxes, and then he found the ring before the movie began, which is why his hand is all damaged, because that confirmed that there are two, but are there more? And so these other memories, when he found out it was seven in that last Slughorn one, he realized, okay, that what I heard about this locket definitely is another Horcrux, and we can pretty much piece together that it's the snake and things and that, blah, blah, blah. That's how it breaks down. That's why it took him four movies more to figure out what Voldemort's plan is.
So the only thing Dumbledore learned from Harry getting that memory is there's seven, because he already knew that there were Horcruxes. He'd already gotten two.
Right.
And clarify one thing for me. If he tore his soul in seven pieces, is he the seventh piece?
Yes.
Okay, so there's six Horcrux.
Yes, Horcruxes. I think it's Horcruxes, but yes, he found out from Slughorn's memory, in addition to there being seven pieces of it, including Voldemort himself, is that it was indeed a Horcrux. That's what they're looking for, as opposed to something else. He wasn't sure that these were 100% Horcruxes that confirmed it was. That's what I got from it, from the movie.
Okay.
And more of that's coming. More of Dumbledore's has suspicions on what this and that is.
How can there be more? Dumbledore is dead.
Well, a little tease for you there, guys. More to come in this vein. But anyway, they're in the cave. There's a whole thing about getting the locket to destroy it.
I don't like this as a climax. I'll just say that this is not satisfying. It's not exciting. Flat out, it may be the most boring climax they've made.
It really could have been better. I thought for sure, having read the book, knowing there were undead people in the water, not knowing that it was PG.
Right! You got zombies? Zombies coming for Harry Potter? This should be good.
This could really have been good, because Dumbledore is down having drank the potion, and Harry's on his own. You could have had a chase here. You could have drawn this out. Instead, he falls in the water and wakes up and it's over.
I don't understand why he didn't try to dump the potion out first. Why did he have to all of a sudden assume he had to drink it? That made no sense. And also, what was funny to me, he looked very much like Gandalf to me in these scenes.
Well, that's funny because the zombies looked like Gollum.
There he The cave looked like it was made out of Legos, which is called that out. The CGI in the cave wasn't that good. But this whole scene, it played out weirdly, and I like some of the acting that Gambon was doing when he said, please. I like what Radcliffe was doing, and I like the acting beats. Yes, the way the logic of the scene played out was poor, but I did like the ideas of what they were doing. Like, he has to drink this potion, he has to be the one, and the sacrifice of Dumbledore, it weakens him so for the next scene. Like, all of this stuff makes sense plot-wise, but how it was executed and explained, I completely agree, is weak in the movie version of what's going on.
Is this the climax, or is it when they return to Hogwarts is the climax? I would think that this is a prelude. And when they get back to Hogwarts, they're high up in the tower. Dumbledore tells Harry to hide, and out comes Draco, and he's super emotional and finally fesses up. I've been trying to kill you this whole year, and now I'm just going to shoot you with my wand.
Well, he disarms him first, and then I love how Dumbledore is just like stalling for time. And then waiting for something to happen, and then the Death Eaters come in. Yeah.
I also like that he keeps complimenting Malfoy. He's like, oh, you did that spell very well. I think he knew how this was going to end.
Yes, clearly.
I don't think that there was any question. He knew that Malfoy couldn't pull the trigger, and he knew Snape was on the way. I mean, there's nothing Dumbledore doesn't know except the number of Horcruxes, apparently.
Right. So, yes, I think we're all kind of saying the same thing. Conceptually, some of these choices make sense, but a lot of this is not satisfying movie climax. It's not particularly exciting, and even the death scene. kind of rings hollow. The whole falling, the kids holding up the wands. I don't remember anybody crying in my theater. I don't think it plays that way.
I like the wand moment very much. I like the slow motion of him falling with that look on his face. I liked how he said please to Severus before he gets killed. I liked how Alan Rickman played the scene. I like how he marched off like Darth Vader at the end of Empire Strikes Back. I liked a whole bunch of stuff in the scene. I understand what you're saying, that the moment is not as powerful as you think it should be, especially how it reads in the book and to see it visually on the screen. And the movie does not build up to this moment in a satisfactory way for you. I get all of that, but I do get enough of it and the music and the visuals for me. I'm not crying, but I feel a little bit bad that, oh gosh, Dumbledore. And then the wands going in the air of the whole school doing that, I thought was the appropriate moment. Then instead of having like a big giant funeral scene, for example, this putting the wands in the air had some class to it, if you will.
I just feel bad for Draco. He didn't die here, right?
No, he ran off with the Death Eaters.
I felt like he really needed to like go too. He kind of got beat up in the bathroom and then he couldn't even pull the trigger. And he's really become, you guys like to make Star Wars comparisons. He's like the Kylo Ren. Or rather, I think Star Wars took from this and said, we need a Malfoy in the Star Wars universe. He just can't do anything right. He can't even be bad.
Yeah, but at least Kylo Ren killed Han Solo, whereas here, Malfoy doesn't even do that. Which makes me think, of course, Malfoy will have to have a redemption arc, right?
God. Okay. You're right, I guess.
If he killed Dumbledore, there's no redemption. So I feel like because he didn't pull the trigger.
So you're saying that for that same logic, then Snape can never be redeemed. Snape is goner.
Maybe he's going to end up being R.A.B. because we're teased at the end of this thing that the real Horcrux is the owner of someone that left a fake in that cave lake zombie pool thing. And we are now going to have Harry skip a school year and spend the next two movies looking for not Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I don't know who it is.
Isn't it kind of sad that the mission that killed Dumbledore was all for nothing? It was for a fake.
Yeah. It definitely is. So, Stuart, Arnie, do you recommend Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince? Stuart.
Yeah, it's funny you should bring up that line, Arnie. All of this was a waste. That's cruel. That's a little harsh. But I did think all of it was a mess. I think the book is messy. I think this movie is better than the book, but it remains a messy and somewhat dramatically inert movie. It's a romantic comedy that's determined to be serious and epic. But if they didn't kill Dumbledore, I think you'd walk away from this feeling like nothing happened. That's really what they had to offer here. The Voldemort flashbacks were few and far between and weren't that good, frankly. And yeah, I can see why I was mad paying $25 for this back in movie theaters. I can see why I didn't feel the need to come back for more. Having taken that journey and explored all the movies and books, I'm a little more invested. But yeah, I made a vow way back with that first movie, I'd never give another mediocre one a recommend. And so I'm not going to. Slogging through mud, maybe, is how I feel about this. Dreary without being sad, dramatic, or scary. It's just kind of there. And they can do better. They should do better.
Arnie.
I actually thought I'd never give another not recommend to a Harry Potter film because I remembered the books. And I actually think that while book 6 has a lot of problems, I like it well enough. And I think if they'd focused more on the Voldemort stuff and less on the rom-com portions, they could have made a recommendable movie. But as it is, this movie is way too slow. There's too much relationship stuff, not enough evil. One necklace attack that I thought was kind of cool. There's some good visuals. I do like the sweeping shot of Malfoy at the top of the astronomy tower at one point. There's some nice CGI camera work. I liked the score that you called out, Brock. I do think it has a good score. But overall, this is a very hollow watch. This is the Deathly Hollow of Harry Potter right here. More than splitting the last book into two movies, they should have brought some of the useful stuff from book 7 into here and then just made one part 7 and not been so greedy, because now I'm really afraid if they couldn't make part 6 interesting, is there enough in book 7 to make two part 7s interesting? But This is the second time I'm giving a not recommend to a Harry Potter film. I really think this one is, other than the death of Dumbledore, there's nothing here you need to see.
I think this one's a vast improvement over the last movie. I think this takes the story as best it can and adapts it. They certainly made the Half-Blood Prince mean nothing in a movie called Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. They really dropped the ball on that aspect of it, but they certainly did everything I wanted, say, movie two to do. They told the story of the book, not as rigidly, but they made sure they had plenty of time for the characters to breathe, to be themselves, and show us how they're growing, changing, adapting, etc. I thought the character work in this movie was brilliant. Even Maggie Smith had something to do here. Flitwick had a scene, for goodness sake. Draco had a scene, many scenes that were good. Ron, Hermione, everybody had their moments and their character beats. You even brought out that great scene about Daniel Radcliffe when he had the luck potion, Arnie. Slughorn was a great addition as a teacher. The performance by Broadbent was great. Finally, I liked Gambit as Dumbledore. So all of these aspects for me make this movie work. But yes, the unfortunate thing is that what I like most about the book and what I liked about revisiting the book in preparation for this movie, they reduced it with less pensive scenes. I don't want a whole movie of Voldemort's backstory. I certainly don't want that. I do know that they're setting us up for the next two movies and what is coming. So I am recommending this movie. It's a Green Arrow for me. It's a weaker Green Arrow only because it's not a great movie on its own. But there's so much good here that I enjoyed so much more than you two did, especially this time through watching all the Harry Potter movies in a row. This one certainly works. I also want to say that this book does not require, we talked a lot about it last time, and we talked about it a little bit this time, how much this was different from the book, that was different from the book. You can watch this movie without having read the book. Some things are going to fall flatter than others, but you will get the story that you need to get without having to fill any gaps in from the book, or not too many major facts anyway. I think they did a great vast improvement over that last movie in that aspect, which is very well necessary from my perspective. If you're going to have a movie adaptation of a book, the movie has to work on its own. I think this movie does. It's just not as good a movie.
I'll agree with that, because in the last review we did, I said it's possible and you guys said it was certain that I was letting thoughts of the book bleed over to the movie. Here, this movie never made me really think about the book other than occasionally, oh, this isn't in the book, or oh, they cut all this out of the book. But I certainly didn't have enough of a companionship here that affinity for the book would influence and improve my enjoyment of this movie.
I agree it is better than Order of the Phoenix, but I disagree that the good stuff that you've cited, many of which is there in Little Pearls, is enough to say that this was a good movie. And again, it was kind of damned from the start, because the book itself was kind of a messy, let me throw it all in here before we really get the climax. She probably should have just made 6 books, would be my guess. But we're going to get movie 7, or at least the beginnings of it, next week.
So thank you, donors and patrons, for joining us again for this Harry Potter show. Thank you so much for your support. It is greatly appreciated by all of us. You guys keep the magic going here at Now Playing.
I'm looking forward to talking about the Deathly Hallows Part 1 with you guys in our next episode. And until then, mischief's managed.
Mind, I'm going to bed before either of you come up with another clever idea to get us killed, or worse, expelled.
She needs to sort out her priorities.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing.
I think that might have been the best moment of my life.
We hope you enjoyed the show.
Bet you loved that, didn't you, Potter?
It's your support that keeps Now Playing operating.
You will find that help will always be given at Hogwarts to those who ask for it.
Go to booksandnachos.com each week to hear our hosts review the original novels on which these movies are based.
I didn't know you could read.
And come back to nowplayingpodcast.com next Tuesday for another all-new movie review podcast.
You'll stay with me
until the end.
Help us spread the word about this show by leaving a 5-star review on Stitcher, Podbean, iTunes, or your podcast store of choice.
This is perhaps the most important memory I've collected.
Want more reviews like this one? In the archives section of NowPlayingPodcast.com, you'll find more than 1,000 in-depth movie reviews from our panel of hosts.
Let's finish this the way we started it. Together!
On our site, you can hear reviews for every installment in the world's biggest film franchises, including the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Star Wars, Spider-Man, Batman, X-Men, James Bond, Middle Earth, Jurassic Park, Fast and Furious, and Transformers.
If you listen carefully enough, the past whispers to you.
Need more Now Playing? Subscribe to our In Focus weekly newsletter for exclusive digital download giveaways, celebrity interviews, behind-the-scenes insights, and more. Sign up through the subscribe page on our website and get it delivered to your inbox every Friday.
This is beyond anything I imagined.
You can also compare notes with us on Letterboxd. Go to letterboxd.com/nowplaying to see what our hosts are watching when we're not recording podcasts.
Every great wizard in history has started out as nothing more than what we are now. If they can do it, why not us?
And follow Now Playing on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and our YouTube channel.
It is the quality of one's convictions that determines success, not the number of followers.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
Do you know why I admire you? More perhaps than any man I know. You do not seek power or popularity. You simply ask, is a thing right?
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
His indispensable assistant.
Now Playing is edited by Heath, Santiago, and Arnie.
Has it ever crossed your brilliant mind that I don't want to do this anymore?
Whether it has or hasn't is irrelevant.
You agreed. Nothing more to discuss.
Artwork by Joe, Justin, and Arnie.
I think it is clear that we can expect great things from you.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
You're saying it wrong. It's Leviosa, not Leviosa.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
Dobby never meant to kill. Dobby only meant to maim or seriously injure.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
Oh, you're gonna regret this. And your bloody chicken.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Sort of exciting, isn't it? Breaking the rules.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2022, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Let us hope that Mr. Potter will always be around to save the day.
Don't worry, I will be.
Ridiculous!
Ridiculous!
It's like the ugliest romantic comedy you've ever seen.
I'll agree, and I've seen the Meg Ryan Alfred Einstein one.
IQ.
Oh, jeez.
That looked like it was shot on a camcorder, and this is worse.
Ridiculous!